This week, we're going to talk about Meta's financials from their quarterly earnings call and Zuckerberg's lofty 2030 goal about where he wants the company's AR division to be. We're going to talk about the We Met in VR documentary on HBO Max about VR chat. And we're going to talk about the US FTC suing Meta again, this time around the acquisition of the Supernatural Fitness app. And that very interesting quote that the US FTC has stated their goal as being to stop Meta from their ultimate goal of owning the entire metaverse. So three very interesting topics to talk about today. Let's get straight into it, Ian.
Yeah, it was a big week for me. There's a lot to process and I'm still processing it. Let's get into that first bit of news. With Meta's quarterly VR AR revenue growing faster than its costs. So Heaney, give us some context around some of these latest numbers.
So yeah, I want to be very clear about what we mean when we say that the revenue year over year is growing faster than costs. So what you can see clearly in this chart is that Meta is still spending far more than it takes in from its AR VR division. These numbers are, to be clear, not Meta as an entire company. This is just their Reality Labs VR AR division. And what you need to do when you look at numbers like this is compare the similar quarters for each year. And the reason you do that is because of the seasonal effects. For example, in quarter four, it's around the holiday season, around Christmas, where people are purchasing a lot of headsets. You can see that that's where the revenue is strongest. So you compare, for example, quarter four of 2021 to quarter four of 2020. So the new figures we've just gotten here are for quarter two of 2020. And what we can see is that compared to quarter two of 2021, there's been quite significant growth in that revenue, but the cost is also increased. They're still spending more. Now, the difference between this and the last quarter is that that growth of the revenue is now greater than the growth of the costs. So specifically, the revenue grew 48% in quarter two compared to the previous year's quarter two, while the costs grew 19%. And that's a big change from quarter one, where the revenue grew 35% year over year, while the costs grew 55%. So there is still a huge, there's still a very long path here to profitability. Meta's AR VR division is still nowhere close to profitable, but you can see a slow shift over time towards profitability. Of course, the spanner in the works there is that Meta's Chief Financial Officer has warned that in quarter three, they expect it to actually contract based on the fact that they're increasing the price of Quest 2, which we discussed last week. And that's likely to make the actual kind of per unit sale cost of Quest 2 not incur such a loss to the company. So in the context here of when exactly does Meta decide to become profitable, or when does Meta achieve profitability in its AR VR division, Mark Zuckerberg recently told his employees, according to a memo that was leaked to The Verge, that his goal is for the company's AR VR revenue to be as big as its current ads business, which is what Meta makes 98% of its revenue from, by 2030. So he's hoping that this will be a north of 2 billion revenue per year, north of 100 billion revenue per year venture by 2030, which is a huge lofty goal, and if achieved, would make Meta one of the largest companies in the world.
We were debating internally, Heaney, what word to use to describe that from Zuckerberg internally, right? He has, in previous years, put the number of users on this chart that he was hoping to reach with VR headsets and with VR platforms. And it was this goal of crossing this boundary of getting to a billion users. But now some of that language is changing into terms of dollars per user in that they're actually spending on digital items. And that's a different way of thinking than just raw people in VR. It almost seems like there was a strategy shift there in what specifically they want to achieve with their goal.
Yeah. So as you say, in this quote again, Zuckerberg still did say, you know, our North Star is, can we get a billion people into the metaverse? And he's saying, if you can even get $100 of revenue on average from those 1 billion people, so that's going to include, you know, every few years, them purchasing a headset and constantly, hopefully from his perspective, them purchasing digital content that Meta would get a cut off. You get that 100 times 1 billion, you have 100 billion, which is roughly their current ads business. So getting from today's number of maybe around 15 million people regularly using VR, or maybe not even regularly, you could say maybe 5 million people regularly using VR, to 1 billion is going to require extraordinary improvements in the technology, the cost, and maybe even most importantly, the content that's available to people. But that's why Zuckerberg is betting the entire house on this. That's why he is rebranding the company to Meta and making this their top priority.
Zach Wilder's comment, just for the people that can't see the graph on our podcast, it looks like the graph is literally bleeding because of how much red there is to describe the costs that Meta has put into its VR and AR efforts. And there's a lot of ways to characterize that amount of money, right? Like, lots of people have criticized Magic Leap over the years for spending a couple billion dollars on its AR efforts when that money could have been spent on startups that could have pursued, you know, smaller startups or indie developers that could have built content that, I don't know, maybe would have had a bigger audience than the Magic Leap 1 headset did. This is also representative of just how much, this red is representative of just how much of a bet Mark Zuckerberg has made on this technology. It's crazy to think that one day that green could outweigh the red. And do you think it's going to happen on Zuckerberg's timeline?
I think it's impossible to predict something like that, but I did some kind of napkin math on this. And if they do manage to achieve the kind of growth that we've seen over this very short period we have data from, because they only started to break out their AR/VR data since quarter four 2020, somewhere around 2027, they actually could break even. And then from there, it would be a very rapid acceleration towards the kind of profitability he's talking about. But again, it's just impossible to really know. If they can get headsets to be slim and light and have face and eye tracking and really high quality pass through and, you know, multiple beyond 4 hours of battery life and bring in all of the kind of features that we talk about on this show as wanting in the future, and they can pair that with compelling content that people really want to use every day, maybe. But again, the you still don't know. The real question is, can they do that while keeping the cost of doing that low enough that they can still make a profit? That's the real question that none of us can really answer.
I'm seeing some great discussion here, and on one great question in particular, it's a comment here. Desitronic saying, in my opinion, it will be 1 billion users in AR and VR, with much more in AR than VR. I love VR, but I don't think it will have the mainstream appeal that AR will. Now, I want to move on and get into some of the later stuff in our discussion, because I think you have to think differently about where technology is going to start think about those categories in new ways. But yeah, what do you want to talk about, Heaney?
No, I think that's the fascinating question that people are constantly bringing up is to, you know, how much of that will be AR and how much will be VR. And the argument I've always found compelling here is that if you're a wealthy person in a first world country that has kind of a lot of freedom to go and do real world things, then AR is going to be a lot more compelling to you because you're going to augment your already great on a global scale life. But if you're one of the billions of people around the world who lives in, you know, a mega city where you really don't have access to do all of these amazing things that we like to do in real life, then VR may actually be more compelling to you because you can then kind of have the same form as escapism that your laptop or your TV provides today, but to a much more immersive degree. So it may be one of those things where in the West, AR is more popular, but globally, VR is actually more popular. And that's, we can never really predict this far in the future, but that's the argument I find more compelling.
That's a really interesting way to chart out that possibility. Really interesting framing for us to think about going forward. Let's move on to this next subject. Last week on HBO Max, they premiered a new documentary that was filmed entirely inside of VRChat virtual worlds. And I sat down with the director, Joe Hunting, to interview him in the studio. You can find it on our channel. And try to understand a little bit the behind the scenes, making of, and thought processes behind this documentary. The poster for this says real connections, virtual locations, I think something to that effect. And right after this premiered on HBO, I got contacted on Twitter by a group of VR chat friends who I met at a local arcade. And they were like, hey, we just met up in the real world after meeting on VR chat. And we're told by the local arcade owner that a VR journalist was in the area. It's like, oh, okay, let's go see what these VR chat folks are about. Met them. I'm still processing that meeting because I want to represent people correctly from VR chat. And there was a lot of work that went into this documentary to just, they don't show the physical representations of these avatars in the real world at all. And the director said that was intentional. They purposefully did not show that because they wanted you to see, the director wanted you to see these people in VR chat as they want them to be seen, as what they want to be seen inside of VR chat. And it's a really, really interesting thing to think about, Heaney. This change in, you know, when I was a kid, I learned how to type ASL in an AOL chat window, you know, as a teen and a kid in the 90s. It's hard for me to think about that being any different than what I'm seeing people do inside VR chat. People are learning how to just describe themselves according to synonyms and learning who they are, what's fun, what isn't. And it's an enormously popular activity that is flying under the radar in a lot of ways because, you know, people want to think of them, people who use VR chat for dozens of hours as like addicted in the same way that people were addicted to World of Warcraft, or that the connections that people even had in World of Warcraft weren't the same as people might get playing a physical sport with someone else. Like, there's always been prejudice against digital connections, and it's going to be the story of the next few years how big virtual connections become and what kind of shape they take as we move forward. Have you had a chance to see the documentary yet, Heaney?
Well, as far as I'm aware, it's not on any other platform than HBO Max. And since HBO Max isn't in the United Kingdom, I have not. I do plan to contact the creator and ask if they mind if I watch it in another way than officially through HBO Max. But, you know, if not, then I'll be watching it as soon as I can in my region. But it really does look like a fascinating documentary, and I do really want to watch it.
Yeah, and do please. I've seen a couple people in our comments saying they saw the interview. Yeah, please go watch it and leave comments and share that out so it gets out there. And the most interesting thing that I took away from that interview, the unexpected thing, was he didn't meet or look at pictures of the real representations of his subjects until the movie was done, so that the way he saw these people in VR chat was the way the viewers would see these people. But then he actually did meet them on the tour of the film, going around to festivals and then finally to a New York premiere. And during our interview, the subjects of this film were actually gathered in the physical world for the first time. And, you know, that even though it's not represented in the film itself, it does, to me, it's a little bit of an epilogue to this whole idea that it isn't just about virtual connections. Like, most people, even if they meet in virtual reality or online, do take it into the physical world and meet when they can. But that's really kind of going to be the story of VR, is that not everybody can or wants to for a whole ton of reasons. And there's a lot of prejudice along the way about just how people move along that stepladder of revealing their real identities after they meet online.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it opens up a lot of kind of deep philosophical questions as to what is quote-unquote real connection. And as, you know, you can very easily say, if you look back 10, 15 years ago, when this is, you know, Second Life or World of Warcraft on a little 13-inch screen in front of you, and you're seeing these disconnected, disembodied characters, that's not real connection. But at what point along the future spectrum of VR technology does it get to the point where to these people it is real in any meaningful sense? When does it get to the point where they no longer even find the idea of meeting up in reality appealing? A lot of people I've spoken to in VR chat are already at that point. They already no longer see a need to meet with the people who they're interacting with in this context in the real world. And as the technology gets more impressive, as we get, you know, extremely detailed face tracking and body tracking and near photorealistic avatars and headsets that can show this visual fidelity at full fidelity, when does it get to the point where it's meaningful enough to them that the mockery no longer is even valid at all? These are really deep questions I don't think anyone knows the answer to.
Yeah, it's going to be a process, right? And I think there's going to be a push and pull. I remember in high school, I had a teacher that really kind of helped frame how society or culture tends to move in like a pendulum between extremes, at least in the United States. And you go through a couple of years where you're kind of politically towards one extreme, and then you go through a few years where you're living through politically another extreme. And I think that might be a really interesting thing to think about, the backdrop as this grows, right? As digital connection grows, we're going to have headsets that are going to be able to reach larger and larger sets of people over time. And the prices are going to eventually lower over time, and that will access larger groups of people with more capable devices. It's going to be a lot of difficult discussions and new terminology and new ways of thinking about how people date in the 21st century. It's really going to happen. I remember in the show Upload, I don't know if you've seen that one yet, but they have like a Tinder of the future where people take video of each other consenting to the interaction before they go through with the interaction. And that was a really, really weird concept to think about for the future.
Yeah, I have seen Upload. It's a great one. But speaking of Tinder, that's a great example. If you had told the average person 20 years ago that a huge portion of society would be dating and interacting and meeting up from an app, or you couldn't even say that, from a supercomputer in their pocket, they would tell you you're crazy. They would say only weirdos date online. That's, you know, that was, if you watch movies from the 90s and from the early 2000s, online dating is almost used as a punchline. And now it's become, according to the, you know, the social surveys I've read, one of the most common ways that couples meet. So it's really hard to predict in the future where this will follow along that path. When will it come to the point where having really deep connections with people who you've never met in real life becomes something that is just entirely normal part of life, just like all of the technological parts of life we have today that would be considered absurd 10 or 20 years ago. Just to respond to one question from Waifu Enjoy, or a comment saying, people don't want ultra-realistic avatars though. Even if you don't have an ultra kind of authentic avatar, even being able to project your realistic facial expressions onto a stylized avatar is still going to be one of those things that's possible in future. You know, it doesn't have to look exactly like your face to still translate all of your facial expressions. Although I would say that on average, I would say people who aren't in VR yet probably will want to prefer more authentic avatars than the kind of stylized avatars that the current niche tech enthusiasts prefer.
Yeah, one of the things I think about the way I've used Facebook over the years, Heaney. I've deleted a Facebook account in the past. Like I said, I plan to delete a second Facebook account. I might set up another one if I need to use it for specific services inside the Meta ecosystem. I don't know what'll happen, but I've deleted identities online that I was no longer happy with. And I was thinking of my first one on Facebook, right? Facebook got big while I was in college. Went, deleted the whole thing because there's photos of me going out and partying, getting drunk. And I'm like, I don't want to represent that. And I don't know if my settings on my Facebook photos are ever, like, I have to go status by status, or I did in the past, to actually get the privacy settings on some of these things the way I wanted them. It was a nightmarish thing. I just deleted the whole thing. The ability to discard that and discard things you've done online over time seems like it's growing in value to people more and more and more as time has gone on. And that's going to be another element of discovering identity through places like VRChat. But I think it does start to move us along to this last section of our discussion today, because, Heaney, this last bit of news happened. I don't think people expected it, even though it could have happened the whole time. Some people that wanted this to happen, but a lot of people, I think, believed it actually wouldn't. So the Federal Trade Commission is seeking an injunction in U.S. District Court to stop Mark Zuckerberg and Meta Platforms from buying fitness service Supernatural. I went through a partially redacted complaint that alleges the acquisition announced last year was poised to close at the end of July, and that it would, quote, substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly in the relevant market for VR-dedicated fitness apps. Heaney, can you put some more context here to what, you know, this isn't the first time the FTC has interfered or tried to interfere with what Facebook Meta is doing?
Yeah, this is the second major suit of the U.S. FTC in recent years against Meta. The first, as was highly publicized, is that they were seeking to undo the acquisition of Instagram, which is fascinating because they themselves approved the acquisition of Instagram 10 years earlier. But this is the first one where it's specifically about virtual reality. And strangely, it seems strange to me that Supernatural will be the place where they would start to take problems with Meta's approach to VR, but I guess they have to start somewhere and they have to find something that is recent enough that they can apply it, because trying to retroactively undo an acquisition from 10 years ago is probably not going to work. So the argument here is that Meta already has Beat Saber, and by having Supernatural, they will essentially start to monopolize this VR fitness space, just as they've tried to monopolize the rest of virtual reality. And you have that, you know, that really juicy quote of saying that if this acquisition is allowed, Meta would be one step closer to its ultimate goal of owning the entire metaverse. Now, it's very interesting that the FTC would say that when we were just talking 5 minutes ago about VRChat, which is arguably, in all practical senses, today's metaverse and today's actualization of the goal of the metaverse. And while it's on Meta devices, Meta has no ownership of VRChat. It's its own startup. So it's difficult to see how Meta would practically own the metaverse in the way that the FTC is alleging. Although if their argument was more specific and they just said Meta will own the VR fitness space, that seems like it'd be a lot more compelling and specific. But even then, if Apple's rumored headset comes along next year with Apple Fitness VR, then Meta is not going to own the fitness space. Apple has a huge health division that it's growing as one of the fastest growing areas of Apple as a company. So it seems far too early in VR's life to say that any company is going to be able to monopolize this. Yes, Meta has used its significant financial resources to gain a large wedge hold, and it's trying to use its financial resources to fund research and development to keep that in the future. But we're nowhere near the point where any company has any viable sense. The vast majority of people who will be using VR in a decade haven't even purchased one headset yet.
Well, so there is this other quote that I'm just going to read out here, because you've covered all of the ground here that we really need to cover. But the quote is, letting Meta acquire Supernatural would combine the makers of two of the most significant VR fitness apps, thereby eliminating beneficial rivalry between Meta's Beat Saber app and Within's Supernatural app. When I read that sentence on its own, it does seem accurate, right? Like, I would say that Beat Saber and Supernatural were leaders of the fitness VR space. There's Fit XR, there's plenty of boxing apps, and all the other rhythm games that can all be categorized as exercise. But I still would call these out as two of the biggest. It's just, keep thinking of Picard in First Contact standing on the Enterprise saying about the Borg, no further to the Borg, right? He's this line, no further. I just screwed up the quote. But anyways, that's who I'm picturing the decision of the FTC to pick this moment as like, this is where we're going to draw the line. And not let it get any further than it is. To put all this in a little bit more context of what's running through my head, right? Last week, I'm covering the Labyrinth golf course launch. I gave my first impressions over on the Gamescast, and there's a course walkthrough on our YouTube channel walking through this course. But the day before the FTC announced this, I'm working on a video where I have walked through the course with Lucas Martel, the head of Mighty Coconut, and asked him, has Meta tried to acquire you? And the way I described it, I'll have to get the actual video out there so people can actually see his response. But it's not a no, is the way I would describe it. He tried to dodge the answer and go with a safe answer, but it was not a no regarding purchase discussions. I did that interview before this FTC stuff happened, and then I'm thinking back on it, wondering, well, if Meta doesn't buy Mighty Coconut, who would be a target to buy that company? Would it Netflix? Would Apple? And then you start thinking down the line even further and wondering, can any of these companies acquire these startups now because the FTC is stopping acquisitions like this? And you start wondering how slippery is the slope. All this to say that there are a handful of companies like Mighty Coconut and Walkabout Mini Golf that if they went to a platform like, say, Steam or to Netflix, there's incredible things that will open up for our community, for VR in general, I would think, with that type of team up. But at a dominant power like Meta, would that still be the case at this point, Heaney?
Yeah, it's difficult to know, but it's also, would regulators intervene in those cases, or would they only intervene in the Meta case? It does seem strange to me, the FTC's decisions, when they decide to act and when they don't. How does Microsoft acquire Activision Blizzard for north of $50 billion? Which is somehow not a consolidation of gaming, and yet acquiring a fitness app in the early days of VR is. How was Meta able to acquire some of the companies they acquired quite early after Oculus? And that wasn't considered a consolidation when that really should have been the time when the regulators struck. Why wasn't tying the Facebook account to the Quest 2 the time when regulators struck? Because that's when in Germany the regulators took issue with what was happening. That's why Quest 2 still isn't sold in Germany, but that wasn't an issue, and yet this is. It's just such a strange way to decide this.
And so I'm seeing some great discussion in our comments, and let me run through the list of acquisitions that were actually listed in the complaint by the FTC. So, quote, January 2020, Meta acquired Sanzario Games, the maker of fantasy Viking combat game Asgard's Wrath. In May 2020, Meta acquired Ready at Dawn Studios, the maker of Lone Echo 2, a zero-gravity adventure game, and Echo VR, an online team-based sports game. In April 2021, Meta acquired Downpour Interactive, the maker of Onward, a team-based first-person shooter. In May 2021, Meta acquired Big Box VR, a maker of Population 1, a multiplayer first-person arena shooter. In June 2021, Meta acquired Unit2 Games, the maker of Crata, a collaborative platform that allows users to play and to create and play their own games. And then in November 2021, Meta acquired Twisted Pixel, a studio that makes various games, including Wilson's Heart, which we didn't previously report about. And so then there's Guy Godin, the creator of Virtual Desktop, one of the most popular ways to view your computer screen in VR if you haven't already used it, in our comments saying, quote, they've bought, what, 7 of the most successful game developers? Any new company who releases a VR headset won't have the top 7 VR games.
Sure, but is it really the top 7? If you look at what they've acquired, the only ones that are essential to the point where, in my view, they would really influence someone's decision, for example, that would make them pick a Quest 2 over a Pico headset, is Population 1, Big Box, and Beat Games. With both of those companies, you could easily have seen a regulator stepping in and making a reasonable case that this was going to be anti-competitive. But Supernatural, I mean, yeah, it's a great fitness app, but is it really at the point where it's popular and highly rated enough that anyone's going to change their entire purchasing decisions over it? And how do they argue that that's different from the strategy of Xbox and PlayStation, where purchasing studios and having exclusives has been a thing since the start of consoles, when you know, right now, if you want to buy an Xbox, you're going to lose out on God of War and Ratchet and Clank and Uncharted and all of these other PlayStation-only franchises. But it's really about whether there's competition. And I think this is going to be one of those issues that becomes a lot more clear when we do get serious competition. By the looks of it, Pico will be the first to really deliver that competition. And what we need to see is does ByteDance give Pico the resources to fund their own studios and their own exclusives that are equal? Or is this going to be something where Meta is able to pull out front? If you look at the current financial weather at Meta, where they're trying to be much more conservative with their spending in this division, it's possible that that will give competitors like Pico the leeway to build up a content library that is competitive. And then it's unquestionable that Apple will have the war chest to fund content to be competitive if they want to go all in on their headset, like it sounds like they may want to. So we're still stuck in this really kind of annoying era where Meta is the only game in town from a practical perspective for the average consumer. But when we do get real, true competition, we can more clearly see what are the moves that are actually going to be anti-competitive against the bigger players that Meta will be taking on.
I think I'll add to your suggestion there, Echo VR as sort of a seller for some folks, potentially. I don't know that anyone's going to go out and get a Quest just to play Echo VR, but I can imagine some people who buy a Quest sitting inside Echo VR once they discover it. But it's still a pretty big thing on its own, that sort of team-based sport. I don't think there's anything that maybe has matched the scale of what that is, Heaney.
Yeah, I think it's great, but as you say, I don't think it's a system seller. I think it's one of the things people would discover and love when they get a Quest. But in terms of system sellers, you're really looking at Beat Saber, VR Chat, and Population One, and they don't own VR Chat. So, yeah, and I guess Rec Room as well. There's the majority of the popular VR content on Quest is not owned by Meta and can and will be ported to the likes of Pico. I'm actually very impressed by the Pico library already. It's already up to the point where it's really compelling. You've got those titles like Arizona Sunshine and After the Fall and 11 Table Tennis and Walkabout Mini Golf and all of these kind of really core titles that get people spending.
Well, yeah, so there was a lot of people in our comments talking about the Pico 4 controllers that are all over the internet right now. We do have a story prepped to go up on that I wanted to work through a little bit before we put up. But we are looking at those controllers, and I think the takeaway there is that the controllers are probably going to be on the lower end cost-wise, and they also have the same button layout that we've seen out of the Quest 2. So the same consistent two-handed physical controller input seems to be embraced by the upcoming Pico system. And that's to be expected, but also kind of a good sign that there could be a lot of content porting from the Quest ecosystem to the Pico ecosystem.
Yeah, it is interesting to see those leaked images. It doesn't really say much about the system other than that this isn't going to be some sort of Quest Pro pricing tier product. They're going to go for something a lot lower. If anyone didn't see our last week's episode, we discussed some of the implications of the Pico 4, and I'd recommend you go back and listen to that. And as Daniel Kaz points out, yes, there is a camera button, but there's nothing ground changing there. It looks like what they've really done is that by shifting that tracking ring of LEDs from the front to over your hand, more like PlayStation VR 2, they much improve the weight balance, the center of gravity of the controllers. So they're going to feel better in your hand than a Quest 2 controller or, you know, a Quest 1 controller or a Pico 3 controller that has that ring facing at the front. So there's a kind of imbalance at the front. But again, obviously probably not as good as the Quest Pro controller, which looks to have no tracking ring at all and have that ability to just move it anywhere. But as a lot of people pointed out, the average gamer doesn't need a full 360-degree, every possible angle controller tracking. They just need a controller that is, you know, reliable and tough and feels good in the hand and tracks well. And by all accounts, both systems are going to have that.
Yeah, sadly, it's Bradley in our comments saying, I've been told that the Pico 4 controller was developed by Gore-Tec and the property was bought by. I don't know if there's more coming there, but I did see in the Pico 4 listing on the FCC filings that product did come out of a GORE-TEC factory, it would make sense that the controllers come from the same place.
Yeah, GORE-TEC manufactures the PlayStation VR, the Quest 2, the Pico headsets, PlayStation VR 2. They are the China-based manufacturer behind the vast majority of the VR market. And it's difficult to know where, just how much they're not in the traditional sense a manufacturer like Foxconn is to Apple, where they just do exactly what Apple's telling them to. There's a lot more of give and take there between GORE-TEC and the manufacturers, where GORE-TEC's almost pushing them and nudging them and suggesting, right, here's what we can make and here's what you may want to make in your next product. And that's a very interesting relationship. And while GORE-TEC themselves is not going to enter the consumer market, you definitely see the influence of their designs and their ideas in a lot of the market. And that's one of the reasons why Quest 2 and Pico 3 are just so damn similar, and why a lot of the Chinese clones of both products are so similar. They're all coming out of that same company, GORE-TEC.
So I was sort of wondering about this possibility, but before we start talking about the price difference that might happen between Quest 2 and Pico 4, if they really go head to head, do you think we will see the Quest 2 discounted to $300 around Black Friday this year?
That's a really interesting question. I guess that they do have the opportunity to do that now. I think it more depends if they have a demand problem. If they see that the increase to $100 by $100 significantly lowers that demand, and they see that a competitor like ByteDance comes in with a Pico 4 and takes away that demand, sure, Meta always has that available to them, but it defeats the purpose of what they're trying to do, and they're trying to make this a sustainable business and achieve higher prices. I guess it really depends on when Pico 4 lands. As we talked about last week, the confidentiality agreement on the FCC filing is set to end in January 2023. So that would suggest that that's when they might be accepting pre-orders, or when they might be revealing the product formally. But who knows? Maybe it could arrive even sooner than that.
Well, so let's just compare them at the sort of suggested retail price here. We've got Quest 2s that are 128 gigabytes, 256 gigabytes at $400 and $500. Price could be different depending on the country based on whether tax is included or not. And you've got that being Meta's pitch alongside this very expensive device that we know is going to be way above $800. It's going to have pancake lenses, better. It's going to show the future of what Meta wants to achieve over time with VR. It's almost like, in my mind, it almost looks like a preview of like where they want to go with next generation devices, more than anything, a dev kit. Whereas PlayStation VR is coming out for the PlayStation 5. People always fight us when we try to compare those markets, even though different markets, standalone versus console or wiring your device into a system. People aren't going to buy both headsets, but still, the PSVR 2 is going to have this step forward in experience between the controllers and its haptics, the headset haptics, eye tracking. It's going to be a pretty big step forward experientially this year at a pretty reasonable price comparatively to where we expect Quest Pro to go. Do we think Pico is going to get anywhere close to that $500 tier of the high-end Quest 2, and what other differentiators could really sell you on spending just a little bit more for going for a Pico instead of a Quest device?
Well, the first thing I point out is that if you actually sum the PlayStation 5 and the PlayStation VR, it's not going to get to Quest Pro pricing, but it's going to get quite far there. You can't just compare the headset when the majority of people don't own a PlayStation 5. And even people who want a PlayStation 5 are still finding it difficult to get one in most markets because of the supply situation. But when it comes to what we'd expect Pico 4 to be priced at, if it is just a refined Pico 3 with pancake lenses, yeah, they can probably pretty easily hit that price, or maybe even lower. Because remember, as Meta's ads business is contracting, ByteDance, because of TikTok, is expanding. So this may be a weird situation where ByteDance decide to come in and take the Quest 2 strategy of taking a significant subsidy on each product to gain market share, while they, their current market share is near zero. while Meta is trying to do the complete opposite and actually bring up their business to be sustainable. So they could be in completely different cycles of business. And if that's true, we could see ByteDance give Pico the resources to deliver a better product than Quest 2 at the same price. And that's when we'll see a real shakeup of the market, because that's when Meta will have to either just take the loss and work towards Quest 3 next year and make sure that it's ready to be competitive in its own way, or do some sort of short-term response of bundling content. And you know, they already have done that with Beat Saber, but bundle even more content and maybe doing, you know, frequent holiday discounts, or even maybe accelerating their plans for Quest 3 to get it in by summer, for example, if their original plan was by winter.
Funky Sloth bringing up my favorite theory. What if PSVR 2 is also a PC VR headset? I do think that would be a major differentiator and a, you know, a big competitive edge for Sony if they really wanted to slow down Meta's Quest 2 a little bit.
I feel like we've had this argument five times.
We're not going to get into it again. But there was another one where people were talking about, let me find it here. Let's go back to the Pop One situation. We talked about it a little bit on Gamescast, but Meta has basically pulled support in Population One for the Quest headset, the original Quest headset. We've put questions to Meta for clarity on that, as well as with Swords of Gargantua. The developer Third Verse over there put out a couple tweets basically explaining that they were going to turn off their sword fighting game. And even the single player mode ran on their server. So that was getting shut down. So two games there where they're running on systems just a couple years old, and they're getting already taken offline in some cases. What do you want to talk about over there, Heaney?
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, that definitely people should go and watch that episode of the Gamecast. Very interesting discussion on that. But Aria Honest has said, Quest 2 and Pico 3 Neo Link are very similar. I wish that their next products have more differences. And from the looks of it, that is going to be the case. As we talked about before in this show, Mark Zuckerberg gave a very detailed interview on the Lex Fridman podcast where he was asked about what he wanted to prioritize in future headsets. And he said, in no uncertain terms, that he would prioritize putting face and eye tracking into future Meta headsets over making them as slim and light as possible. Whereas if you look at what Pico's strategy seems to be with Pico 4 based on their FCC filing, they will have a base model of the Pico 4 without face and eye tracking and then a pro model with it so that they can separate that cost from the lower tier and let people who are solely interested in solo gaming or kind of not telegraphing their facial expressions to get a cheaper product. But it looks like if Zuckerberg's words are be taken literally, which I think they should, that Quest 3 may not do that. It looks like when they do come to Quest 3, he may prioritize making that product more bulky, more heavy, cost more, but have face and eye tracking so that across the entire Meta ecosystem, as Quest 2 starts to get fade out and become less and less a percentage in the long-term arc of Meta's product line, people, everyone in the Meta ecosystem will have that face and eye tracking. So it does look like ByteDance and Meta are going to diverge in that sense. And if those ByteDance regulatory filings are to be believed, they will prioritize thin and light pancake lens headsets over giving everyone face and eye tracking.
The Pro did have face tracking listed for Pico 4 Pro too, right, Heaney?
Say again, sorry?
Didn't the Pico 4 Pro have face tracking listed in its FCC filing as well?
It did, unless I'm mistaken. It said the only difference between Pico 4 and Pico 4 Pro is face and eye tracking.
Yeah, okay. So there is an attempt there to do it. I was going to throw up this video I captured right before we came to the studio. It might be a little bit stretched out widescreen-wise, so I apologize for that. But this is the first hands experience on App Lab that just launched from Meta as a sort of experimental demonstration of full hand-tracked interaction. So I'm doing this to make a shield with my hands, and I've got the laser beam Tony Stark hands with another interaction there, where the thing about face and eye tracking that gets me, Heaney, is you have done an incredible job tuning the lip sync in here with all of your with all of your coding, I've not seen lip sync that's as good as what you're doing here. Like, I know other people are doing it maybe as good, but I haven't seen anything that's as good as what you've pulled off here. And I've seen it in our comments where some people have been fooled, a few of them have been fooled into wondering whether we've actually got real face tracking active in this studio. They're wondering what we're doing to do this. And it can be a surprise for a few people out there that this is just stock Quest 2 hardware. Well, like, Heaney, when we have face and eye tracking, when you actually have that on, let's say it's a Quest Pro, do you think you will ever use a Quest 2 again in this studio?
No, definitely not. I think it's going to be one of those things that, for contexts like this, where you're having a near field social interaction with other people, like be it a app where you're playing chess or an app where you're playing kind of all their virtual board games, or they're doing meetings like in Horizon Workrooms, it's going to be a feature that is essential. So if developers in the Meta ecosystem over time can rely on that, then you're going to get these more and more social experiences that are built around being close to people, because you do get that extra fidelity. But then again, there is that added cost in bulk that has to be factored in. A really interesting comment here. Or sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's just better hands, better facial expressions. And there was another video there that I didn't quite capture, but they did have Heaney in that first hands interaction, the gravity gloves, or a version of the gravity gloves, for just barehanded hand tracking. So I was reaching out with my hands and pulling objects toward me, just using open air hand tracking. It's on my own. You may not be able to pull it up, Heaney, but I was trying to pull it up. I couldn't earlier. But it's, yeah, these gravity gloves, but it's just open air hand tracking. And that opens up the whole area across the room. And what I'm seeing with that particular example is a demo that's going to be incredible on Quest Pro, right? Or Cambria, right? Like, that first hands experience should be far and away much, much better on that hardware. And then if you layer in hand tracking and eye tracking on top of there, like I said, why I asked you that question, I don't see myself going back to a Quest 2 once I have a Quest Pro. And it's as simple as that, right? Like, the issue, like, yes, we will want to upgrade, but there's a real possibility here that if Pico picks the right features to put at a low enough price point, they could actually reach a larger market by not including face and eye tracking, even though it could be such a big step forward for you and me, right, Heaney?
Yeah, exactly. Because despite ByteDance also being a social media company, it looks like Pico's efforts in VR, at least in the short term, and at least from what we see publicly, are not centered around the idea of social connection. They are just trying to be a kind of, at this point in time, definitely a general computing platform. Obviously, they have their business, a gaming platform. Obviously, they have their business use cases where they're trying to provide businesses with the tools to do training and visualization. But when you look at Pico's consumer offering, it is very gaming focused. And that's arguably a very good business decision in the current short term. The vast majority of consumer VR usage right now is still gaming. So Meta is trying to almost tell consumers what they want, in the sense of saying this platform, this new technology is for social connection. Whereas right now, a lot of people still aren't fully sold on that. So it may pay off in the long term, but you're right. In the short term, Pico being able to deliver those lower prices means they very well may be able to reach a larger market.
Yeah, to bring a lot of our conversation full circle a little bit, I'm seeing this comment from Enjoyer talking about live 2D and the Apple face tracking API with iPhone dominant VTubing will be interesting if low-cost face and eye tracking will start to make a dent. Heaney, I've talked about this concept of having a holographic phone call where one person represents themselves as an avatar and the other person is wearing a VR headset, and the person representing themselves as an avatar just has a phone in front of their face and they're projecting themselves into virtual space that way. The same thing could be done in the inverse, right, where you're wearing an AR headset and you're in the physical world and you could project avatars around you that way. I don't know how great an experience it would be necessarily for the person on the other end if you're holding your phone in a really awkward position. But we have yet to see holographic phone calls in that way, Heaney, where like even in Horizon Home, it is not a great flow to get a party together and then get them into an app. We still haven't seen this situation where like you and I can connect from like an iPhone to a VR headset in a really efficient way. And we're still almost, you know, a long time away. The Vive Pre in 2016 had that feature of like taking our calls inside the headset. And we're still here and we still don't have that whole system worked out. When we have that, Heaney, isn't this like going to get a lot more interesting? Like won't people's brains click a lot more once they realize that like, oh, there's actually a real benefit to showing my avatar instead of my actual self, even in work settings, right? Like I keep thinking about this situation with Portal, right, Heaney? They've moved Portal off to their business unit. And I can only think of Portal making video calls more efficient, right? Like there are plenty of people that will go out and buy a Portal to present themselves in the best possible way on video chat. But that means having a dedicated space for children and dogs and mess never happens in front of your Portal device. And we've got a real situation where people are working from home to an incredible degree. Not everyone who works from home has everything clean and ready for display on video chat. VR is the answer to that, right? Being able to show a virtualized version of yourself when you don't want to present your actual body should be pretty common going forward, shouldn't it?
Yeah, just to come back on the first half of your statement and question there about the idea of communicating from VR to something like an iPhone by avatar, it's definitely an interesting idea, and it's definitely something that companies love to talk about and pitch, and futurists, quote unquote, love to talk about this idea of, oh, it doesn't matter what device you're on, you can access the metaverse, whatever that is, from your phone or your laptop or your toaster, and it doesn't really matter. But at the end of the day, it's just not going to really, it's not going to achieve what's really magical about social connection in VR, which is that shared sense of space. It's the fact that when you're on a webcam, there is no alignment of physical space and coordinates. You are looking at a flat screen that is looking back on you. And when you point towards them, it's not the same as when they point towards you. When you're in a physical space with someone in VR, it's like in reality. You can have a shared object in front of you and you both look at it and you both have that sense of space. When you're with multiple people, when the person left you talks, you hear them coming from your left ear. You hear the person to the right of you coming from your right ear. There's a sense of space both visually and from an audio perspective that feels exactly like the same sense of space you get in reality. And that just can't be replicated from holding a little rectangle on your phone and seeing a tiny miniaturized version of someone. It's just not the same. So yes, avatars will solve for those sort of problems of the practicality of having webcams in a real home for work from home. But at the same time, to get that real social experience that VR promises and to really make this something that people want to use in their life, they're going to need a headset or glasses.
Yeah, interesting breakdown there. And I'm seeing a lot of people talking in the comments about just the various issues here that I'm seeing Enjoyer talk about how, people hate using the webcam. And I'm in that boat where I would prefer to keep the webcam off. And there's a lot of work that's been done at the software layer, Heaney. Even you in this studio have done work to take out the background noise, right, Heaney? That's an incredible different, like, that opens up so many possibilities when you don't have to worry about the dog barking in the background. You can have a focused professional discussion, even if your environment isn't really ready for you.
Yeah, exactly. In the same way that we're seeing that on all the platforms like Teams and Google Meet and Zoom, that they take out your audio background. In a way, when we have photorealistic avatars, VR will be taking out your physical background instead of all this current situation where working from home isn't very kind of professional or organized because of all this background stuff and because of, you know, everyone's kind of connecting from, you know, be it their bed or their home office or their kitchen half the time. people are essentially magically teleported into their ideal office that the company can set up in any configuration, and you can have shared documents and 3D objects and all of the files that you need in a space. So this kind of technology is very likely to accelerate the adoption of remote work, which the pandemic already caused an acceleration of, and means that instead of having to have people fly across the world for meetings that they really can't get done in any practical sense on a video call, you can start to have a lot of that done in virtual spaces that are just going to get better and better. Even today, they're still more compelling to a video call in many ways, but that's only going to accelerate over time as headsets get slimmer, as avatars get higher fidelity, and as the software that enables this gets better and better as the developers learn more about VR and AR.
Well, thank you so much for everyone in our comments today. There's some really interesting discussion. Heaney, did you see anything else you want to call out before we head to the end of the show here?
Daniel pointing out, and someone else I think also said this, that they really wish that field of view would be prioritized. You know, we're still talking about all of these future headsets getting slimmer and lighter, but at the end of the day, field of view is what fundamentally drives immersion. And in a social context, it's very important, because I was just saying, wasn't I, that when someone's on your left, you hear them to your left, and when someone's to your right, you hear them on your right. But with the current headset, you can't actually see both people at the same time. You're going to have to turn your head to see the person on your right and turn your head to see the person on your left. But it'll become a significantly more immersive experience, and you'll really feel like you're with a group of people when that field of view is stretched out to the point where you can actually see people on your right and left, so that you can be in an entire group and see everyone at once and pick up those subtle social cues that someone wants to, you know, talk and interject, or that someone is kind of moving an object that's relevant to your work over to the other side of your peripheral vision. So that'll be fascinating to see.
Yeah, well, we've got a very busy couple weeks coming up here at Upload VR. We've got Backseat VR Developer on Wednesday, so that's coming up tomorrow on the YouTube channel. We've got Gamescast on Thursday, where I'll be talking to Harry. And then Heaney and I will be meeting for the first time on Saturday in Cincinnati, where we'll be meeting up with Kyle. Let us know if you're in the Cincinnati area and there's anything VR-related we should be checking out there. And then next week, we will be at SIGGRAPH, the Computer Graphics Conference, where I very much look forward to picking Heaney's brain about everything I find there and seeing what he thinks of it. And then we will be back in here after that as we digest everything that we found at SIGGRAPH and get on with the next steps of covering all these next things that are kind of come out. We expect it to be a very busy couple months as we head toward the end of the year here. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in this week. We'll be back later. What's that comment, Heaney?
James O'Loughlin saying that you'll be giving me a Turing test IRL to test for fidelity.
No, we've already joked. Heaney and I have already joked that interaction will go exactly like it did in Westworld. That if Heaney can train an AI on enough minutes of me in here, that I'm going to wake up after I die and he's just going to be sitting here with me, and he's going to be the Ed Harris character.
What do you think the purpose of this entire app has been? He's going to be really scared by that now.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll leave everyone off with that thought for this week, and we'll have more of those types of thoughts as soon as we're able to get back in here with a new live show. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you in the future.
I'll see you after SIGGRAPH. Can't wait for those fun 12-hour flights. Really enjoy those. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.